As much as we say it's a disease model, so many people still buy into the moral model where they judge people for using anything, including drugs that aren't even getting them high, which is like, so do we buy into the disease model or do we not? Like, the moral model is what stopped people from getting well forever. And even us in recovery, if we're wielding the moral model at other people trying to get clean, in this day and age where like literally one use will kill people, like, I think we're missing the boat on that. And so, yeah, I feel passionately about this.
So that was Mike Miller speaking to some of the toxic behaviors that can happen in certain recovery circles. Mike certainly knows what he's talking about when it comes to recovery. He's 20 years sober, actually. His first episode when he appeared on the Ashes Awesome podcast was his 20-year anniversary some months ago. So he certainly knows what he's talking about. He's very well-spoken. And you've got to listen to this episode, or you've got to watch this episode. It is absolutely informative, I guess, and certainly shed some light on some things that we could do better at as a recovery community. Anyway, Mike is also the head clinician and co-founder at the Yatra Treatment Center here in Krabi, Thailand, where I reside. Guys, if you've been following, you know, I started my healing journey here in Thailand at the Yatra Treatment Center. They treat trauma. They're really, really good at it. So check them out. They are a clinic run by clinicians, not a business run by businessmen. And they know that where addiction is a smoke, trauma is a fire. You can learn more if you check out their website at theyatracenter.com. That's yatracentre.com. And here's the show. Hello, everybody. Watchers, listeners, supporters of all kinds. Welcome to another episode of the Ashes to Awesome podcast. I'm your host, Chuck LaFlange. Joining me in virtual studio on my side of the world is Mike Miller from the Yatra Center. How are you doing today, Mike?
I am good. Chuck?
Good, good.
Happy to be here. Bit of a different sort of deal to be here on a Wednesday. And
Yeah, it is. So, and speaking to that, my regular co-host, Ryan, has got some personal things going on, so for today, this is what we're doing. We'll see what the future brings, right? But so to anybody that's curious, Mike, we were talking before the show about kind of some of the toxic behaviors that we're running into online. And there's a meme that I want to bring up. And just now that I'm thinking about it though, and of course we didn't discuss this, but hey, the best episodes are made that way. Maybe give us a bit of your history as it pertains to 12-step, because that's where this conversation is going to get into, and okay, just kind of establish some credibility if you could, right?
Well, I don't know if I'll establish credibility, but I'll tell you my story. So background, I started drinking when I was 12, added in marijuana by 14, hallucinogens by 15, cocaine at 16, heroin by 18, jail at 18, selling drugs, like, you know, the whole, like, drugs were my life kind of thing for a long time. First went to 12-step treatment when I was 29, maybe. Okay. And then had almost a year clean in 12-step. But, you know, didn't really know that much. When I started hanging, I had a bunch of friends that got clean before me, guys I used to use with. And so I kind of thought, you get recovery by osmosis. Like, I'll hang out with them. They're like all a few years clean. I'll do what they're doing and I'll stay clean. But, you know, I wasn't doing all the stuff new people kind of need to do. And, eventually relapsed at just under a year, took a dirty cake, right?
Dirty. I've never heard that term. It's pretty obvious what it means, but just in case somebody doesn't know, what do you mean?
Relapsed at 11 and a half months, but I had already, at my home group, we had already arranged to celebrate the year clean. And this was in Vancouver, where you would bring a cake and celebrate the sort of birthday, if you will. I had used. And so my mom was there and her husband, who's been basically the one solid male role model I've had since I was about 12 years old. And it was the first time he ever said, like, they got asked to share. And so he said, Mike's my son. And like, I'm just crying. And everyone's like, he must be so proud. And I'm just like, so shame bound because I'm loaded. And
wow.
It was rough. And then I went on a tear after that. Like, I'd only used, not to minimize it, but just factually, I'd used two times in those 2 weeks. And then after that cake, I just went on a tear for like another probably year and a half. Then I went back into, and during that time, like try a meeting here, try a meeting there, you know, but didn't really take, if you will.
Yeah.
I wasn't, to be honest, I wasn't really trying to be clean. I was trying to get my significant other at the time off my back. You know, just trying to do some damage control and convince her that I was like making an effort, and I wasn't, but you know, that was, where I was at the time. And, you know, you thank goodness for that third tradition, right? Like the desire, like I wanted to be clean. I just kind of didn't know how to do it and wasn't willing to put in the work. So, anyway, I ended up like using for another year and a half or so, and then went back to treatment, 12 step place, AA based, very, you know, is publicly funded. So not a lot of people with higher education, qualification, skills, et cetera. You know, they quite often hired from within the client base. You know, people that have been around for a while, they would end up hiring on as support workers. And, I stayed there for 6 months. You know, you had to read a chapter of the big book every day. You know, all the groups weren't actually therapy groups, but they were like, sort of like studying the big book and that kind of stuff. Got to go to meetings, do your step work, do all that. So it was very, very 12-step based stuff. But it gave me safety and structure and support. And so I stayed there for 6 months. Then they did what they do, which is they hired me. And I couldn't live there and work there. So they sent me to their sober living place. And at that point it was in like a sort of satellite neighborhood, like a town outside of where I was at. And so I was living in the sober house, getting on the bus and heading to the center to work. And I got a home group in the community that I had moved into, started going to lots of meetings, got a service position at my home group. At this point, I'm like 6 months clean, so can't even remember what it was, to be honest, the first position I got. But, you know, basically they got the NA railroad going on. So like, you know, they were like, oh, you'd be good for this position. I was like, okay. And they're like, we nominate you. And then who's all in favor? And I got elected into some position that I didn't know what it was. But what it did is it brought me accountability. I had to show up every week. I started building relationships with these people. I was committed to going. So I was going to like lots of meetings every week, doing service, had a sponsor. And so after that, I went from doing service at my home group to doing service at the area level in NA, which AA, I think it's called intergroup.
Okay.
Different language, same thing. So people from all the home groups around go to a one area. And I got a job as the group service representative. And that was my service position. And then I was got elected at area. I was vice chair of area for a while. Then I got elected in as a regional committee member. So I was going to regional doing service, like this is over a span of years, right?
Okay.
Then I moved out of that community and, stopped doing service because I was in a new community and I was working a lot. You know, I'd done all the like going to school and I was working in treatment through this whole time. So I worked at a 12 step place for a couple of years. Then I moved and worked at another 12 step place for a couple more years. Then I was doing outpatient treatment, doing medical monitoring and making sure that, people. So I was working with safety sensitive individuals. So like cops, sheriffs, nurses, pilots, city workers, longshoremen, bus drivers. If they had presented at work with a substance use issue, they would see the addictions doctors I worked with. They'd get sent to treatment. And when they came back, they had to come and see me once a week. And I would do breath, urine, blood, or hair samples on them to make sure that they were actually staying sober. And I remember one guy saying like, you just want to catch me being loaded. And I'm like, dude, I'm like a 12 step guy. I'm clean. Like, I don't want to catch you being loaded. I want to prove you're clean so that you can get your license back and go back to work. So I did that for a few years and doing outpatient treatment. Then I went back to working in a rehab that was not 12 step based in Thailand and did that for the next 9 years or so. But yeah, so even in Thailand, you know, I moved here when I was almost 10 years clean and started going to meetings, doing service again. I was a programming chairperson for a area convention where it was my job to get speakers internationally from all over the world to come and speak at this convention. And so, yeah, there's been like, yeah, I'm over 20 years clean and I identify as a 12-step member and I definitely go a lot less now than I went to in the beginning, but I'll never not kind of
identify as that or
And it's crucial. Yeah. Like, I wouldn't be where I'm sitting today if I wasn't immersed in it, especially for the first 5 years. And then, so I think I have a pretty good working knowledge of the steps and the traditions through the service and, you know, the local guides to service. And, you know, I've been pretty involved for a long time, I think. And now I have less involvement now, but I still think I'm fairly well versed in it. Which, if that makes me credible, I don't know, maybe.
I would say it most certainly does. I mean, that's the most history any guest has ever had on the show as far as 12-stepping goes. So, I mean, it's safe to say you know your shit, right? Certainly more so than me. I mean, I'm not a 12-stepper now, though I was in the, I've often said my first 30 days doesn't happen without the room. So, you know, I very much do believe in it. However, what we've cut, it's come up quite a bit in social media as of late, but throughout the life of the show, it's been an underlying fear of mine that when I bring somebody who's a 12-stepper on, that they are militant even, or kind of zealot-ish about the 12-step, and you know, 12-steps are no step and all those things that you hear, right?
Specifically, you're the steps guy, motherfucker.
Yeah, and I will say, I have had this concern, I don't know, a dozen times out of 223 episodes. Literally every one of those times that I've had a guest on that I was like, oh, is this going to be one of those? It's never been. Literally every person that's come on, it's been an unfounded fear. It's turned out to be this whatever works for you kind of attitude, right? Which I do appreciate. However, in the world of social media and keyboard warriors and the kind of, I mean, hey, the internet has done so much good for recovery, but there's this other kind of undertone, specifically about being clean and sober, right? So,
I mean, the internet was supposed to be like access to all the world's information in one place and this wonderful, glorious thing. And then, of course, it's like also massively toxic in a lot of different areas. And I do know, like, I'll tell you right now, just the fact that we're talking about 12-step stuff and it's not going to be 100% glowing, I think, like, you know, because we're going to be honest about like the really, really good stuff. And then maybe some of the limitations of it or some of our experiences that maybe haven't been amazing or that other people's experiences haven't been amazing. Like my guts just churn because I have a fear that I will, like, I'm sticking my head above the parapet and I'm just going to be like, totally targeted, but I, you know, really clear, like I am a huge proponent of people doing 12 steps. I also take one of those principles that they say are the cornerstone principles. You know, they say honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness, we're well on our way. And I take the honesty and the open-mindedness and I shine those back at 12 steps and go like, well, honestly, the program is pretty solid.
Yes. Yes.
And honestly, there are members of it who might divert from some of those principles in how they are, because like, let's, you know, just be honest again, using honesty, you don't show up there because you're well, like, that's just not like when you walk in the door, you're probably not at the peak of health or you wouldn't be walking in. And then if we're open-minded, like if I shine that at the 12-step program, like there's a lot of really, really good, amazing, useful stuff. I wouldn't be sitting here today without it. You wouldn't be sitting here today without it. We would have never met without it.
Right. On and on and on and on it goes. Right.
Yeah. But also, like, if I'm actually living by the principle of open-mindedness, I should be able to understand that there are other ways that people get well or use to bolster their recovery that go, that dovetail nicely with 12 step. And so I think, yeah, so I get all nervous just being like, if I'm not just going to give 100% 5-star, I recommend kind of review to it, like, then I'm going to get like lambasted by people.
And you know what, if you click on Mike's icon inside, you know, 808podcast.com/trauma, you'll see, for anybody who's listening or watching right now, the first episode that Mike did with us, after that episode, he was quite concerned, if you don't mind me saying, about some of the things that you said might be misconstrued or whatever. And of course I can totally appreciate why, because it can be a very reactive community, I guess, seemingly. That fear has been unfounded more often than not, but
people care about it a lot. This is the thing.
They do.
It's like,
they do, right? And for good reason. for good of course. Fucking reason, right?
It's changed their whole lives.
Yes.
And I think, but I think what happens is for some people, it shifts from, like I'm recovering to live to like I'm living to recover. And my identity isn't I'm Mike and, you know, I'm a therapist who runs a trauma treatment center and I'm a husband and I'm a friend and, you know, I'm a tattoo enthusiast and I'm a motorcycle rider. And like, you know, it comes down to this very thin description. I'm a recovering addict 12-step person. And if you say anything about the 12 steps, it rocks a bit of my identity because yes. I've invested so much in this being the way. And for me, it might have been the way, but if someone else says like, hey, maybe it's like 90% great, but not 100% perfect. Like I might get really reactive to that because it's threatening, like something that I view as being very sacred to me, being very important to me, transformational, life changing, et cetera. But then that can come out like what happens when we get threatened, right? I feel hurt. Yes. I feel fear. And that doesn't feel very powerful. So then what comes after that? Anger. And, you know, and if you're on a social media sort of setting, like you said, keyboard warriors, like lashing out on internet is not how people usually, like people don't usually interact like that in real life. But when you have that barrier of the computer or the screen or the phone or whatever, like it's people let fly people with some stuff.
Yeah. Right. Oh, it's ugly. But it's ugly. Right.
And sometimes.
I did want to open this up, Mike, with a meme or not with a meme, with a screenshot of a conversation that was online, a comment to somebody that really, it disturbed me, I think, for lack of a better way to say that. I'll read this comment to you, right? This isn't one of the angry ones. This is one of the ones that the anger has affected.
Okay.
So this fellow said, the sober community is by far the most toxic community I have ever seen, man. Ouch. All have almost died, destroyed our lives to finally get off hard drugs, even if you're on subs or methadone, just to get completely put down about being a junkie in denial. What a shit show. Right. Yeah. And to me, that is horrible. That one person feels that way about what is realistically the go-to kind of only way or that you can find fellowship in your early days. Right. As you more into recovery.
Well, it's definitely the most prevalent. More people.
Yes.
Right, and most accessible.
Yes.
And
yes,
most, right. And most prescribed. Not just by people in it, but by professionals and medical people and counselors. And
have you gone to a meeting, right? I mean, right.
Yeah.
So for one person to feel that way and to say it, you can, how many people? And then if you take and
how many aren't really, saying it?
If you, yes. And if you extrapolate that, how many people didn't go back to a meeting? How many people went back out and how many people died?
Yeah.
Because they're feeling that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I mean, it makes me sad. I mean, also like, to be honest, like this sounds like a person who was hurt and then, you know, there's a bit of hyperbolic, like the most toxic, like it's, you know, like it's obviously this person's quite activated. But that might be their experience for sure. I don't want to minimize that, but it definitely sounds like a pretty emotional post. It makes me sad that anyone that would go to a place that I think saved my life would have an experience where they're like, oh, that's not accessible to me.
Right.
When, you know, this, I always go to this. It's like, if I want to know how to act in a 12-step room, like I just go to the traditions, right?
Yes.
So what my experience is when, you know, I'll use your words, like some people can, I think you said like be sort of like zealous, right? Like, like almost like zealots. And I think that some of those people, while standing up for 12-step as like the only way to do it, like this guy saying, if you're on subs or methadone or whatever, you're a junkie. So basically it's saying like, he's been sort of judged or ostracized for being on some form of a replacement therapy is what it sounds like. Right.
Yep.
I mean, I'm reading into that, but that's what it sounds like. Yeah. And if that's being done by a 12-step member, it's really weird because a 12-step member who's actually living by a 12-step program would look at tradition one that says, our common welfare comes first. Our personal recovery depends on NA unity, which means I don't ostracize anyone. Tradition three says the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop using, right?
Yes.
Yes. You know, and I'm an NA guy, not an AA guy, although, like I said, I read a chapter of the Big Book every day for 6 months while I was in treatment because I was afraid to not do it. And I knew that book pretty well in and out. And then when I worked there, I started teaching that stuff, but at least studying it with people. But as an NA guy, like, there's actually a pamphlet that's called In Times of Illness, like an informational pamphlet, IP number, whatever, I don't know. I'm not that good at it. I can't quote page numbers and everything.
But, hey, listeners. Let's take a moment to talk about something crucial. Carrying naloxone. This life-saving medication can reverse an opioid overdose in minutes. You might think, I don't need it, I'm not around opioids, but the truth is you'll never know when you'll be in a situation where you could save a life. It's easy to use, and many places offer it for free or at a low cost. So let's be prepared and look out for each other. Remember, you might not plan on being around opioid use, but you never know when it'll be around you, and you could save the life of somebody that is loved. This is Jared Blaine with the Blacklist Podcast. And remember, you are loved.
P number, whatever, I don't know. I'm not that good at it. I can't quote page numbers and everything. But that pamphlet, In Times of Illness, says, like, sometimes we are required to take medicine, right? Like, it's right in the program. It's in the fucking program. And people who are like, no, you need to do this program are like, but you're not even following the program. Because if you were, you would understand that we don't ostracize people, we don't judge people, that they don't need to be doing it your way, whatever your way is. They need to be doing it the program's way. And the program's way says, all you need to do is have a desire to stop using. We don't turn our backs on each other. We don't judge people. We actually, tradition, I'm going to get it wrong. I'm going to say tradition can't even remember. But anyway, there's one of the traditions, I want to say six, it's not going to be six, that says, or maybe it's in How It Works, one of the readings, it says, we have no opinions on outside issues, right?
Yes.
Your personal confidential medical information is an outside issue to my recovery. Like, it's
100%.
literally none of my business. You know, so I know nowadays, like, it's a lot around the mat stuff and around, like, the substitutions, you know, the replacement therapies and all that, opioids in particular. But when I got clean, there was a bit of that with the methadone, but there were people who were telling people in the rooms, you're not clean if you're on antidepressants. And I remember thinking, you're really fucking dangerous, pardon my language, but, like, you're not a doctor, you're not this person's doctor, and you don't know what happens if they destabilize by coming off this medicine. They've come here for help around some form of substance use. They're definitely not taking antidepressants to get high. And if they go off of this because you've shamed them, what's going to happen to them as far as stabilization and in their recovery, but in their, like, mental health? And to me, it's like, again, the program doesn't fucking say that anywhere.
No. No,
and yet some people in the fellowship who probably, for whatever reason, maybe they're just not well or not as well as they could be. I'm trying to be, like, kind of gentle about it. But, you know, or maybe they've been taught that, because sometimes we're a bit like the blind leading the blind. Like, we hear something and then we parrot it and repeat it. You know, like, when you get clean, they go, don't get in a relationship for a year. And I, like, you know, sometimes I kind of play the devil's advocate and I go, show me where it says that.
Yeah,
like, it literally doesn't say that. Now, there's logic behind it. Like, I'm not saying it's a completely invalid, but someone heard it. It sounded cool. So they repeated it. And someone heard that and it sounded cool. And then it becomes almost this thing, like, it's part of the program, but it's actually not part of the program. That's it. I'm not saying it's not wise in any way, but don't try to weaponize it against someone. And I think the thing about the medicine is, like, it's irresponsible to try to judge someone for whatever medication they might be on. Because it can be really dangerous, because, like, how people get well is none of my business.
It's really not, right? It's really not, you know, and
I know that people get very triggered and activated when other people are on some of these medications. And I always get, like quite curious, actually, right? I like, curiosity is, like, one of these, like, aspects of self that I like to kind of engage in if I can. And it's like, why does it bother you so much that someone's on medication? Like, which, why is it?
Speaks directly to my meme most recently. If I'm spending my time judging other people's paths to recover, then perhaps it's my recovery I should be judging. Right. And it's right there, man. Why are you so angry? Why do you feel the need to be angry enough to hurt somebody else with your words?
Yeah.
Right. That's trying, you know,
and, what step is that exactly? I don't have a copy of the steps here. Which step is it where you judge other people and make them feel like shit for trying to get well? I don't really know.
Right.
Now, you know, I would like to say this because, of course, there's that part of me that's afraid I'm going to get fucking lambasted here. This is not the majority of people. Like you said, 12 times out of 12, it's been an unfounded fear. Like, this is not the majority of people. But it's just like, if you talk about politics online, it's the vocal minority. Right.
Yes,
people who like need to have their voice heard. So I don't want to like, you know, I'm a 12-step member for a reason. Probably 85% of my friends in my life that I value a lot are 12-step members. Like, you know, and that's just because most of the people that I know that are 12-step members do the very best to be the best people they can be. And it's very important to them to be the best people they can be.
Absolutely. So, which has absolutely been my experience on the show. 100%.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's my experience in life. But
Lisa quite often speaks to, and just because she's the person that said it, not, of course, she's not a 12-stepper, Dr. Lisa, my co-host from the Weekend Ramble, but she says it's different rooms, different, you know, every, you fill up with a room full of these souls and a room full of these souls and different things are going to happen. Right. And
yeah, so, for sure.
You know, she was kind of speaking to Al-Anon, I guess, in her experience, right?
Because
her experience was not positive. However, right. And I think in somewhere in this online mess of arguments and comments that I've gotten myself into over the past week, few days, whatever, has been a qualifier that I had to say in there is literally zero of these groups were started with the intent on making people feel this way.
Yeah.
Well, I would be willing to bet literally zero of the people got into them with the intent on making people feel this way.
Agreed. Right?
So it's something that happens with evolution. Personalities start to take over. You know, isn't there something about that too?
But well, there is.
Right?
Yeah. Well, principles for personalities. You know, that's tradition 12. But there's also concept. Oh, I don't know. So the people don't like. There's the 12 steps. There's the 12 traditions. There's the 12 concepts of service. And one of those concepts of service talks about the spirit of rotation, so that different people are always in different service positions, so that a room doesn't take on the personality of any sort of individual. It doesn't become Chuck's meeting. It's like, no, that's an AA meeting that Chuck is a member of, right? And so it's hard in small communities. Like, people sometimes there's only one person willing to keep the meetings open, but the rotation stuff is important. But I might have sort of gone off on a bit of a tangent there, but when you say people didn't show up there to make people feel like that, of course they didn't. They showed up there because they were desperate and wanted to get some help. And then this is the part that I find like forever baffling to me, is when people get clean or sober or whatever we want to call it, that are in recovery, when they start judging other people who aren't as far along the continuum of recovery as they are, I'm like, where is your empathy, man? Like, I see like friends of mine and, you know, and I can kind of understand it, but they like say they live in an area where there's like crime. Because, like, you know, and let's name why it is. There's a systemic problem where people suffering from substance use disorders, addiction, whatever you want to call it, can't access enough resources to actually get well. So they're left to kind of like, you know, find their way through this thing. And sometimes they resort to crime to do that. And I get friends of mine that are clean, like literally using words like fucking junkie and stuff. And I'm like, whoa. There's just something in me that's like, I understand being upset if your car got broken into or if your neighbor's car got broken into. Like, I get that, right?
Yes.
But like, can you not empathize with someone who's that desperate that seems like a solution in the moment? Like, that's someone who's in a lot of pain. Their behavior shit, for sure, right?
Well, absolutely.
But can we separate the person from the behavior and be like, what's driving that behavior is someone who's in a lot of pain? And so you know, when it's people in 12-step rooms who are judging other people for certain, whether it's like harm reduction measures or whatever, I always just think like, how did we get to a place where that's part of a program of spiritual principles, which I don't like, I don't really know what that means, but you know, because spirituality means different things to everybody, but I can't see how like judgment, shaming, and ostracizing is like a spiritual a set of spiritual principles.
In any, you know, whatever your spiritual values are, right, or beliefs are. So, my experience. Go ahead. What are you gonna,
I was going to say, can I tell you, like, I'm sweating right now just having this conversation because I watch you on social media sometimes, like, weigh into some of these or make a comment or put a meme. And I always go, oh, fuck, man. Like, I wouldn't put myself out there like that. And so here I am kind of putting myself out here, very aware that I'm trying to have a balanced kind of view of it and be like, you know, what we were saying beforehand. It's like, what I'm actually doing is defending the 12-step program.
100%.
Because if people actually live by what it says in it, none of this shit ever happens.
Yes.
Period.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't. Yes. We live by 100%. The traditions. We live by the principles. None of this happens. We get people in and we go, yeah, man, you're having a tough time. And, oh, you're going to do this thing in order to get to there? Cool. Like, let's get you to there. How can I support you in getting to there? Because you know what? I've sat where you're sitting and it sucks.
Yeah, it does. And that does. Right.
And, you know, we know the way out. So follow us instead of being like, oh, you're fucking doing it wrong. It's like, I find it incredibly frustrating. I find it heartbreaking. I understand why people like the guy that posted that comment, why he would lose faith in the program's ability to help him if that's what he's coming up against. And again, vocal minority, not most people. In my experience, most people have huge hearts. Like, you know, I have a friend of mine who every Christmas he opens his house for people who are like sort of NA orphans. You know what I mean? Like their parents aren't around or their families aren't around or they're single or they can't see their kids or whatever.
Which would be kind of the norm, maybe not that specific thing, but definitely the normal in my experience, right? In my experience.
That is the norm, right? I think, actually. Yes. That is the norm.
Right.
People like having that type of open heartedness. So I just want to be
100%.
Like, it's not everyone, but when you see it, it's so powerful.
A great example is tell somebody that the reason you're not going to a meeting is because you don't have a ride.
Yeah.
Right. Watch what happens. Right. Watch what happens. It's crazy, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, you got a queue.
We're in Thailand. Somebody said that to me in Regina, maybe 2 months ago now, 6 weeks, 8 weeks ago. And it was like 10 minutes later, you have a ride to every meeting you ever want to go, man. Just like that. Right. Two countries, you know, three cities got involved. And it like in 10 minutes, the guy had, you know, because that's the nature of the people in those rooms. Well, right.
And, you know. And let's actually say this. You're not actually in those rooms, but you know that the support in those rooms is there and you accessed it for him, even though you're not even in it. You're just connected to it.
Right.
And it's still so that powerful and that fast.
That is the reality of it.
Yeah.
When, you know, it's done. I don't want to say properly because it's not my words, but, you know, when it's done in the spirit that it's meant to be, I guess it's the way to say that.
Well, when you actually live by the principles of the program, including the steps and the traditions. And I think for me, like, there's so much good stuff in it when people are adhering to it and, you know, to the best of their ability, but not like living in conflict with it. Right.
Of course. Right.
And I think like, that's why, when you get some of the comments that you've seen become so jarring because it's so outside the norm. It's like, you know, there's a mega church down in America, down in the United States. You know, the guy's got this huge, crazy church and he's got like fucking mansions and jet planes and all this stuff. And there's a flood in the area and he locks the door of his church. And it's just like, whoa, like, it's so antithetical to what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah,
like you're supposed to actually be the first door that's open. And I kind of equate it to that. It's like if our whole thing is about the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. And the addict who's supposed to be helping you is actually judging you, shaming you, and ostracizing you. Like we have lost our way. Regardless of whether or not I want to participate in those medicines or that harm reduction measure or that behavior or whatever it is, doesn't matter. My job isn't to police other people's recovery actions. My job is to, you know, have a spiritual awakening, practice the principles in all my affairs, even with people who are doing things I don't fucking like.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And carry the message.
Yes.
Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, I practice these principles in all my affairs. So all my relationships, doesn't say the easy ones or the ones that I fucking like. It says all my affairs and carry the message. And I would say saying that what you're doing isn't acceptable, shaming you for it, judging you for it, saying you're not clean, saying you're not sober, whatever the language is, I would say I'm not practicing the principles in that affair in particular, and I'm definitely not carrying the message. I'm also breaking tradition 11, which is that our public relations policy is attraction rather than promotion. And what I'm doing is I'm definitely not attracting people. I'm not luring you into the fold through, like, this is how we live by this program. I'm probably, you know, we have evidence of it with this guy with this comment. He's like not coming back. And that's a shame, because that might be the room that saves his life. And that's so, yeah, it's just jarring when you see it, because it's so not what it's designed for or what the norm is. It's so outside the norm, right?
And it's more important than ever. I do want to talk about my experience with 12 steps, and because it directly correlates to this. However, I think before I say that, Mike, we are living in a time unparalleled as far as drug use goes. This has never happened in history. Right.
Yep.
So what worked for you, what worked for anybody that's been sober for longer than a few years, what worked for anybody that has not had a serious opiate addiction? It's not the same. You have to, now is the time that you have to, you should be more willing to accept other paths to recovery, because people are dying faster than ever. Nothing that in human history outside of war compares to the numbers and plague and fucking plague happening out there, really, right? Most certainly an epidemic, right? And bordering on plague right now. People are dying, right? I've been out of it for 16 months, and I've had way more phone calls than 16 phone calls and messages, right, about people we've lost.
I know when I got clean, the amount of those phone calls that I would get are a lot less than the amount of phone calls I get now. Just because of what's actually out there, whether it's fentanyl or carfentanil, you know, like these things are like so fucking powerful. I think that this actually illustrates a bigger thing, which is like, hey, I'm all for the big book. That big book was written in 1939, right?
Yes.
And it's done like countless
oh my God. Yeah. Right. Like it just,
you literally can't even quantify the good that's come out of that book, but it's almost like blasphemy. If you're to suggest that in the 85 intervening years, we could almost update it.
We've gone more than half an hour and now you fucking went and did it. Okay.
I know. I did it. I know. Well, any other field in the world, including like, this is the thing. People say this is a disease, right? Fair enough. Yes. Whatever. I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to, you know, I have my ideas about it, but whatever. Let's just say this is a disease. Well, 85 years ago, they had an idea about how you treat the disease of cancer. In the intervening 85 years, they have done a lot of leaps forward in technology, research. You know, like there's like a lot. And the way that we treat cancer is different than we did 85 years ago, because we have a much bigger source of data. We have a much bigger source of research and knowledge and advances in technology and medicines and everything. If you went to someone with cancer and go, why aren't you treating it like we did 85 years ago? They'd be like, that is insane. We know more stuff now. But when it comes to addiction and you deal with some people, maybe those few vocal minority that can be a bit zealous in their defense of the 12 steps.
Yeah.
Why are we taking a book written by a stockbroker in 1939 who had been sober for 4 years and only worked with 100 people and saying that's the fucking untouchable Bible, and how dare you think about updating that? Because I'll tell you this. I've been clean five times longer than that guy was clean. He was 4 years. I'm over 20. He worked with 100 people. I've worked with an average about 300 a year since I got clean. So we're talking about like 6,000 people. And I'm not saying I'm fucking Bill Wilson. I'm not saying that. But what I'm saying is, like, the way I look at it when I treat people is I go, well, what's the latest research say?
Yes. Yes.
I'll take the stuff from the 12 steps. It's really good. That's solid. And I'm going to keep that. But can I add stuff to it that's actually going to be evidence-based?
Yes. Yes.
Because these medicines.
That feeds into something, Mike, that part of these same comments. And I want to jump on that evidence-based research. Mm. one of the conversations I've had was actually with another influencer or social media recovery content creator, I should say. I don't like the word influencer. Edit that out. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to.
Yeah, just be humble. Just go with
it. Right. Is this myth, and it is a myth, that Matt has led to more overdoses. Matt, people never get off Matt. People never, you know, methadone for life. It's Suboxone for life. And listen, it takes a quick Google search of peer-reviewed Matt's or peer-reviewed studies on the effectiveness of Matt with SUD.
Yeah.
And the amount of papers is overwhelming to a point where in response to this other content creator, I just went to ChatGPT and used like this summarizer thing that it's a research thing. I said, can you just summarize what all of the papers say? Because it's just too fucking much to read. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And it has, there's so much evidence
that
no, it's not forever. Your limited experience with people that it hasn't worked for is sure in your mind, you know, very valid, but in big picture, it's not right.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a couple of things. One is anecdotal evidence is not actually evidence, right? No. I mean, it's a true story because you've experienced it, but that doesn't make it true across the board. And it's not, there's no double blinds. There's no like sort of figuring out like any confounds, like taking out skews to the research. Like when there's a consensus, not of people doing research, but a consensus of the research itself. We've done this study and 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 100 fucking studies. And they all come up with the same thing. And they've had those confounds ruled out and they've had peer review. Like at that point, this isn't a matter of, because this is the second thing, emotional reasoning, right?
Yes.
People have feelings about these medications and they think their feelings are facts. And, you know, like, don't bring your feelings to a fact fight. Like the point of it being like, just because you get some feelings about it or triggered by it doesn't, and you feel it's bad, doesn't make it bad. Because the truth of the matter is, you know, and I'm from Vancouver and I remember when the supervised injection site, the first one on Insight got opened up and all these people in recovery and all these people out of recovery and all these politicians who love to stoke fear and anger and resentment were saying, this is encouraging people to come to the downtown east side and shoot drugs. And it's like, that is complete bullshit. There's no evidence that that ever happened. The evidence of what happened is people are shooting up anyway. Can we keep them alive to the point that they can access some services and then get into a more stable and recovery based life? And there's never been an overdose there. Never. Yep. There's literally never been a lethal overdose.
By far the busiest such facility in the entire country, by far. I'm sure. I mean, I don't have any evidence to say that, but I'm sure that they would be.
I know a guy who's clean for years now who was revived from overdoses there 6 times. Wow. Like, right. If he's not there, he's dead.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, and he's not alone in that. I'm sure they're like, you know, again, this is anecdotal, but the evidence, the actual research papers show that this isn't encouraging people to go and shoot up. Like this is a place where people, that were already shooting up could do it in a safe way so that they could stabilize. And then they have access to resources. Cause some of them, that's the very first place they actually have someone there. That's like, hey man, do you need some help? Because guess where you're not getting that? In the fucking back alley. Right. Yeah, so stuff doesn't rigs, get
their dirty needles aren't being left. Like, there's a million reasons that's
a million just, reasons. Yeah. Yeah,
right. That's so much better.
So like, I think that I might have feelings about someone shooting up, whether I'm a person in recovery or a normal member of the community or whatever, and that's fine. But the truth of the matter is there's evidence about this thing that and the mat and all that, like they work, they keep people alive long enough to get into recovery, including stable abstinence-based recovery, which they wouldn't have a chance to do if they weren't using those medications. Now, here's the other thing I would just say. Why the fuck do I care if someone's on methadone for the rest of their life? Like, how is that my business? How does it affect me? Why do I get on some moral high horse and judge it? Like, do I want to be on methadone for the rest of my life? No, absolutely not. I don't want to be.
No.
And, you know, like, and I am a recovering heroin addict, right? So if that's what the language we'll use, heroin was my deal. And I'm grateful that I didn't get on methadone. And I don't particularly enjoy thinking of the times that I kicked, and there was many. And I don't particularly enjoy thinking about the last time I went to treatment where I kicked cold turkey and was lying to them and saying I was clean for a week, and had to get up in the morning and do chores and go to group and do all that, like while like really sick. But I'll tell you, I never want to do it again. All of that being said, if someone else can do it a different way, why do I care about that? Like, really? Like how is, right. Like,
why?
I don't
why
understand that. Right. Yeah. Why to me in my life.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like yeah. I equate it a lot of times to people getting physically fit, right? Mm-hmm. So say you and me are both like fitness guys, which I mean, as evidenced by this, it's not really true, but let's just say, right? And you're like, well, what I am is like, I'm a power lifter, right? And yeah. I go, I'm a CrossFit guy. Like,
yeah.
Do I sit around disparaging power lifting, or do I just go to CrossFit and do my thing and get healthy? And why would I care about how you choose to get healthy? It doesn't exactly. happen in those worlds. It happens particularly in the recovery world, because as much as we say it's a disease model, so many people still buy into the moral model where they judge people for using anything, including drugs that aren't even getting them high.
Right. Right.
Which no, is like, yeah. So do we buy into the disease model or do we not?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
yeah.
The moral model is what stopped people from getting well forever. And even us in recovery, if we're wielding the moral model at other people trying to get clean in this day and age where like literally one use will kill people, like I think we're missing the boat on that. And so, yeah, I feel passionately about this stuff because I believe that there are so many good people and so many good aspects of the 12-step program that I hate to hear people turning away from it and saying, I can't access help there because I get judged. And that is heartbreaking to me because I wouldn't be here today without it. And it's like, 100%. If someone did that to me, I'll also tell you this, based on my trauma history, all it would have taken was me walking into a room and having someone judge me and shame me. And I would have ran away as fast as I could and never been able to show my face there again. And I wouldn't be clean today. 100%.
Perfect. You've done it twice in this episode. You just said a nice segue into my next point, outside of your awareness. So my experience is I've started to say a couple times here. When I relapsed after 34 days, it's the first 30 days ever that I ever had as an adult sober, right?
Huge.
It was.
Yeah, it's huge.
When I relapsed, when I relapsed, and my group, my home group, was amazing and open and caring and all of the things that you would not just expect but want it to be.
Yeah, and hope right? for it to be.
Absolutely amazing. I can still say Megan, who's not an anonymous person, I can say her first name most certainly.
Yeah.
She came to a meeting when I was at Detox. She chaired a meeting there. I connected with her story. And the day I got out, it was like, I'm there, right? She was just the most amazing human being. Yeah. When I had to go back to zero, the idea of going back to zero is what kept me in relapse. And I say that to say, that's how easy it is to scare somebody out of the rooms. Everybody else around me is taking pride in their clean time. And I would never tell somebody, don't take pride in your clean time. No, say, maybe you just be a little more aware of, I don't know. I don't know how to wrestle with that one, Mike. And maybe you have some thoughts on it. Because it's a big deal. It's a big deal. But at the same time, it's why I didn't go back.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, it's a double-edged sword, right? In that counting those days and those milestones sometimes are the things. Getting those key tags or those chips or whatever. Like, I remember how important it was to be like, I'm going to get a 30-day key tag tonight. Like, I remember that feeling. I also remember relapsing. And being too ashamed to come in and say, I'm coming back, because I was already shame bound in myself. And it was,
as are so many.
And I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want to be abandoned, because that's my history. My history was judgment and abandonment. And, you know, like that's just part of, you know, trauma histories, I think. And so I think like, it's good to take pride in it. But this is one of the things too that I think, and this is one of the limitations of the 12 steps. And as much as the 12 steps is fucking awesome, what's it going to do about that, like fear and shame of judgment, fear of abandonment? Like my sponsor might be an amazing guy and might be really good at his day job, but like, he's not going to help me resolve why I feel that shame, why you felt the shame too much to be able to go back and be like, I had to lose my clean time, so I can't come back here. Because there's underlying stuff there. Right. And so I don't know that in 34 days of clean time, any community led mutual self-help group is going to address that. So I'm not sort of blaming that on the program, but I'm saying like, there needs to be other stuff that people access to address the like, well, why was I so shame bound in that? And maybe that's post relapse. And maybe, you know, my hope is, I always heard like, there's no shame in coming back. Like there's shame in not coming back. You know, I remember relapsing and then coming back and relapsing. Like literally when I went into treatment, I put all my stuff in storage that my mom had to pay for because I couldn't even afford the storage fees. And when I went from treatment to that storage locker to get some stuff out of it, I opened this dresser drawer and it was full of white, green, and orange key tags, like brand new 30 days and 60 days. Like I could have started a newcomer meeting. There was so much stuff because I did like, you know, when I was ashamed, I wouldn't say I was coming back most of the time, but then I would go and I'd get a 30 days when I got that again in a 60 days and then I'd relapse and I'd go through that sort of cycle. But I remember going to my home group one time in the West End of Vancouver and this woman, I remember the conversation, but I don't know who she was. And I actually regret that. She said, "You don't know how much NA misses you when you're not here." And I was like, whoa, like, nobody in my life tells me they miss me when I'm not here. They're actually usually quite glad to see me going in the other direction, right? Is what it feels like anyway. So like, yeah, I don't know where I kind of went off on like a little tangent there, but it's like, I don't know. It's so important that acceptance and that like just being accepted for who you are and where you are, et cetera. For me, like what kept me from being able to say I was coming back was my own shame. And maybe it's not the job of that program to take care of that. Maybe it's the job of that program to help me stay clean, get connected to a group of people that can support me and do that. And then it's my job to seek outside help for specific issues that come up that can't be addressed by that program or for whatever reason aren't addressed in my experience of it. Like some people, maybe they resolve their shame in 12-step programs. Amazing. Good for them. That wasn't my experience. And, you know, we all have different experiences based on the complexities of our cases and everything.
Of course.
But yeah, I think it makes me sad to think that, like, that all or nothing kind of thing, right?
Like,
if I get loaded tonight and I go back to a meeting tomorrow, am I at day one?
Technically, and this is actually where a lot of that argument started with that other content creator, was that conversation right there. Am I at day one?
Yeah.
And he was quite upset that somebody would indicate anything less than day one or anything other than day one again.
Yeah. Like,
but no, I've started to change my language quite a bit. And I just say the day I embraced recovery, right? Because, and for me, yes, that is the day that I became abstinent and it's been whatever 16 months and whatever days now, right?
Yeah.
But I just... Because what if that person has that one day? I figure I'm not going to contribute to that.
Yeah.
There's a toxic ego that can happen with, you know, well, I've been clean for this long, so I know better.
Yeah.
And I, you know, fucking chest pounding, crap, condescending. Oh,
well, it's funny.
And that I've seen much more often than somebody who's zealous about, you know, about 12-stepping.
Well, and we've talked about it before. Like usually the ego is... directly inverse to self-esteem, right? So it's like the ego is protecting me from some deficit that I see in myself or something that's too painful. So I kind of puff myself up because it's like, feels better, right? But I know two different people that both have significant time in recovery and both of them, and these are people that don't know each other. They've probably never met. I did ask one of them to come speak at the convention that I was like the chairperson for.
Okay.
She came and spoke about trauma. And that was like, people were like, oh, trauma at like an NA convention. And I'll tell you, standing room only. Like people were like eating it up. It was amazing. And her story was amazing. But both of these two people that have significant clean time each, both do this thing where they go, there was that one night in the middle. Like I had a bunch of years clean. I used like once or one night. And then I got all these years clean again. And it's like, they feel like they have to mention that night.
Yes.
Even though they want to be like, you know, the whole total of it is the important thing, but they feel like they're being dishonest. If they, like, you know, let's say, for example, I'll just make up numbers. One of them is, you know, it was clean for 10 years, used one day, and then got clean for 20 years after that. They want to say they're clean for 30 years, right?
Yes.
But they feel this need to be like, well, I was clean for 10 years and I used one night and then 20 years. And you can see this struggle in them where, like, one of them in particular, because, like, it's the clean time is important to them, right?
Yes.
It's changed their lives. But they feel they would feel shamed if they weren't mentioning that one thing. But they feel shamed when they actually mention it because they feel like it took away, like, it broke up the continual. But I would look at it like this. That one night, you didn't lose everything you lost in the 10 years. And actually what happened was because of all the stuff you had in that preceding 10 years, you got right back into it the next day. And so it actually did its job for you. And then so, Mike, you put 20 years after. Like, it's hard.
Is there anywhere, you know your shit when it comes to the 12 steps. We've established that now.
Well, I know some of
it. Is there anywhere in the steps, the traditions, in the book, anywhere, that says that you'd go back to zero?
No, because it doesn't actually, like, we celebrate clean time, but it doesn't actually, I don't think it says that anywhere. I mean, now, to be honest, like, there's actually been new literature published that I haven't studied to the same degree. So, but I doubt that it would say that. Like, I'll just say.
If anything, yeah, you'd be getting further away from that than anything, right?
Yeah. But I think that sometimes there's that, like, and it's really sad to say that this would exist in the recovery community, but I think there's some people that have that, like, Schadenfreude, right? Where it's like, I like to see other people fail because I can feel more sort of elevated from it, right?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt, right?
And it would make me sad to think there are people like that. And I don't know that there are, but there might be that element of it. But the truth of the matter is, like, when we put everything on the days that we have, like, what we're missing is, like, what did I learn in those days? And because I'll tell you right now, maybe the content creator person would say, if I use tonight, tomorrow I'm at day one. It's like, well, maybe I'm at day one as far as, like, counting consecutive days, but you're not going to undo everything I learned and all the therapy I did and everything in the last 20 years. I don't lose all that. And I remember, like, for years I've been having this conversation with clients that have relapsed. And I'm like, you didn't lose everything. You might have lost that day count. If that's the most important thing for you, I guess we just need to build up another big day count. But that's not the most important thing to me. The most important thing to me, like, if you look up recovery in the dictionary, there's like a lot of different definitions of it. The one that sort of applies to medical stuff that I've seen says to return to a previously known state of health. It doesn't say counting days.
Yes.
It doesn't say attending meetings. It says, like, return to a previously known state of health. Now, to me, in the time that people get clean, if they're living by a program and doing what they need to do, to get healthy and be as healthy as they can, to some degree, whatever that looks like, like, that's the stuff that you don't just all of a sudden lose it. Like,
no,
you might,
of course not.
You might veer away from it for a bit. Mm-hmm. You might have a relapse, but, you know, for me, when I was in treatment the last time, I was the new guy in the group, and I might have told this on one of the weekend rambles. There was 24 guys in the room, and I was at one far end, midway of the group, like, we were in a big circle. At the front was the director and a support worker.
Isn't everybody in the middle of a circle if you're in a circle?
But I was directly in the middle from them, where it started.
Okay.
Because the director said to the person on his right.
I'm just being an asshole, Mike.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to ignore that. So he turns to the guy on his right and says, tell me something you're grateful for. And it goes around, all the way around. And everyone's like, my kids, my family, my this, my that, my job, my blah, 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 blah. And it got to me. I'm 4 days clean, newest guy there, still in withdrawal and pretending I'm not because I lied to them and said I'm sick.
That must have been hell, man. Oh, my God.
Yeah,
okay, continue going. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was June and it was fucking hot. And yeah, I'm sharing a room with two other guys. I'm on a bunk bed. Like, it was not good.
It's the worst
day. Yeah, it was terrible. In group on folding metal chairs in a converted garage. No aircon, no fan, no nothing. Like, but it was good because, like, it sucked enough. I don't want to do it again. But but it gets to me and they say, oh, what are you grateful for? Like, new guy, what are you grateful for? Right. And I'm like, yeah, I'm grateful for my last relapse. And like, you can just hear this like, oh, but like, I wasn't grateful for the using because I was clean for 11 and a half months and I wasn't doing all the stuff I needed to do to change. I was like just fucking white knuckling it and holding on for dear life. Mm-hmm. One little crisis happened that wasn't even that big of a crisis. The next thing you know, I'm using. And what it showed me, and it actually says this in the NA book, sometimes a relapse, I'm going to paraphrase, I'll get it wrong. Sometimes a relapse is something, says something like the event that brings about a more serious application of the steps or something like that, or a more like basically it says like you learned what you weren't doing and you need to do more. Right. Yeah. And that's what I learned. I was like, oh, I can't half-ass my way through this. Now I'm in treatment and I'm here to do what I have to do. And everyone was horrified. Like, this guy doesn't get it. Right. And it goes around all the other guys and it gets back to the front, to the support worker who's next to the director. And he goes, oh, like the new guy, I'm grateful for my last relapse because without my last relapse, I wouldn't have the year and a half clean that I have now. Yes. And then all of a sudden, all of a sudden people are like, oh yeah, like that was valid because it came from the guy who knows what he's talking about.
Which speaks to the whole, what you're saying is not valid if you don't have the clean time. The fact, what I'm zoned in on there, I so much of what you just said, Mike, but one of the things that kind of sucked out was they actually labeled you the new guy, referred to you as the new guy?
No, that's me.
Okay.
But that was the sort of attitude, like the guy with 4 days clean who's in withdrawal doesn't know shit. And you know what, to be honest, I didn't know a lot about recovery because I'd never really done much of it. You know what I mean? I'd been abstinent, but I hadn't done enough to change what I wanted to do to sort of stay clean and to return to health, right? I was still keeping secrets and doing all the bullshit. I didn't change. I didn't amend anything, to be honest. I just stopped using. So basically we took away my medicine but left me with my pain. And then I had to like eventually return to the medicine, right? Because if we ask a lot of family members, like if you're using, and I ask your mom, like, what's Chris's problem? She's going to be like, the drugs. Or, what's Chuck's problem? The drugs. And I ask you, Chuck, what are the drugs? And you're going to be like, they're my solution to like living, you know, like that was my medicine for the pain. And when we took away the medicine and I didn't replace it with anything, then I was just left with the pain. And it was a matter of time until I was going to use again. So I didn't really know a lot about recovery. But in that moment, what I knew is that I needed to learn a lot about recovery. When I was there, people would say like, oh, where do you live? And I'd be like, here. And they'd be like, where? Like in like Vancouver? And I'm like, no, here. Like, this is where I live. I don't live anywhere else. This is, and I stayed for 6 months. And I remember the director saying to me, like, we may as well put you to work. You're not going anywhere. You know what I mean? Like, clearly you're not leaving. So we may as well like put you to work.
Maybe I should have stayed at Yatra for a little while longer.
Well, we got work permit issues that are a bit different. And oh, sorry, we have this other thing that's called ethics.
Ethics.
Dual relationships and all that. But, you know, like, I think that I knew that I didn't know enough. And I knew that I needed, I think it says to bring about a more rigorous application of the steps is what it says. And I knew that that's what I needed to do, even though I didn't know that sort of quote. I was like, okay, I can't half-ass it. I have to do something different. And that, you know, was it good that I had almost a year clean? Sure. I did minimal damage to people in that time. I wasn't a drag on a lot of social systems in that time. You know, it also didn't do everything I wanted it to. It did show me, oh, I can do this. I've done it before. Without even putting in a lot of the effort I was supposed to put in, I got almost a year clean. What's going to happen if I actually do what they say to do?
And
at that point, I remember like in that same group room, 24 guys there, and they brought out the stats. And it's really funny. Like, treatment centers will always tell you the stats. And I don't know where the fuck they get these stats because I haven't seen peer-reviewed stats of this stuff. But they said, of you guys in this room, a year from now, two of you are going to be clean. Two of you are going to be dead. And the rest are going to be in and out, or just out using. And I remember saying to myself in my head, now you're all fucked because only one of you is making it. Because I'm fucking making it. And I was like, I don't know how to stay clean. Show me how to stay clean. And I'm going to do it. Because I was like at the point where I was like just desperate. at the 1 year mark, six of us were clean and celebrated it together.
So
20 yeah. years later, there are still two of us clean from there.
Wow.
And so, I'll tell you, at a year clean, two of them were dead. So that sort of played out, and a lot of them were in and out. And, you know, but you can destroy those stats, whatever they say the stats are. Like, if you want to stay clean, you can stay clean. And the 12 steps is a great way to do it. But it's not going to be very useful if you go there and feel like you're not accepted.
No, most certainly, right? And that's a great way to kind of bring about this whole conversation, Mike. I've been more than open about I'm not a 12 stepper. I've never worked the steps. But I'll say, by extension,
stay clean.
right.
I'm joking. You're going to. Yeah.
No,
you do it any way you want, man. It's cool.
Oh, of course I can, right? And I know that. I take no issue with it. By extension, though, the amount of people in my life that are 12 steppers, the amount of people I've had on the show that are 12 steppers, so many of those principles have been applied to my life.
Yeah.
So many of them. Right?
I mean, this is what it is, right?
I can't tell you how many times in a normal week that I'll say, is this who you want to be?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, so you're doing a step 10.
Do this instead, right?
So you're doing a step 10.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
You're doing a continuing inventory. Like,
yeah.
I remember one of my colleagues, the support worker who actually said, like, oh, like the new guy, I'm grateful. He said to me when he saw the 12 steps, excuse me, he was like, so sort of like, whoa, that he took them to his grandmother and went, grandma, look at this. And she looked at it, went, yeah, that's how you're supposed to live. Like what, like it wasn't this big mystery to her. Like, you know, be a good person. If you do some wrong, try to right it, you know, like it wasn't a big, you know, it's, but it's the principles. There's principles in all those steps.
When we very first met, Mike, I think there was some schedule conflict or something. I don't remember what it was. I don't. But, and of course, met, I mean virtually, because that's how I was still in Canada at the time. But something had come up, and you were so off-put at the idea that you weren't going to be able to make the commitment to whatever that time or date was.
Mm.
And I remember, and I still, it's that in particular runs through my mind quite a bit as I do what I say what I do, those things.
Mm.
And you kind of set a bar for me at that time. Because, of course, when we first met, what was I, like 4 months in or something like that, maybe, like give or take, right?
Yeah, around, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's been a year.
Yeah, 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 right? So I was fucking, I was a hot mess back then. But
that's not kind language.
No, but and I don't even mean it in a derogatory way. I just was, right? I had so much going on, right? And
It was quite chaotic and stressful. It was stressful. Right? You had a stressful existence then.
I really did, right? But you set that bar, and it's a good example of kind of the spin-off effect that happens with a program like with 12 step, right? Like
so,
and literally every time I'm not going to make something or I'm not going to do what I said, whether it's I told somebody I was going to update the website, or I was going to do a podcast, whatever. It drives me bananas.
Yeah.
If I don't acknowledge that and make that right, and because of what you said that day, right?
So this is the thing. To kind of piggyback on that. So being a 12 step member for a long time, including when I was in that place getting clean, when I was doing the steps, I had to do, you know, step two, right? Come to believe in a power greater than yourself, and I was like, well, there's all kinds of powers greater than me. Like, that's not like nature, the police, the government, like, you know, a gang, like what, like there's tons of powers greater than me. Like that one wasn't that hard for me.
Literally any pretty woman on the planet. Right? Okay.
Sorry. No, I don't know what you're talking about. But you know, like to me, like I actually went with kind of like a scientific thing. It was like, could I lift that sofa? No. Could me and you and two other guys in recovery lift it? Yes. Oh, therefore the fellowship is a power greater than me. Like there's just evidence of that, right? So that's kind of how I did that. Step three talked about, made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. Well, I didn't understand him. I watched other people in that house being like, oh yeah, God, my higher power. And I was like, you're halfway home. And I I struggle with it. I didn't grow up in a religious household. I didn't believe in it. I didn't want to believe in it, but I was so desperate that I was like, I'll try, I'll do the prayer and all that kind of stuff. But I felt really fake when I was doing it, because I was like, I'm praying to something I don't believe in. It feels really disingenuous. So one night I like didn't pray and the sky didn't fall in. And I was like, okay, so like I'm still clean. Nothing really bad happened because I didn't pray. And over the years, at this point, I'm like a few years clean. And not, I didn't pray for the few years. I stopped that in the house. But a few years clean, I was like, how am I staying clean in a 12-step framework if I don't believe in God? Because, you know, sorry to rock everyone's world. Like, I just don't. And that's okay that you do. You're like ahead of me in that. And that's okay. But I had to figure out, how is this working for me when God is like listed in like five or six of those steps, right? And I looked at it and I was like, well, I live by a set of values to the best of my ability, like be honest, be responsible, be accountable, you know, have compassion, have some integrity, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And when I do that, when I live in line with those values, I get connected to other people because they like being around people that are honest and compassionate, as opposed to like dishonest and manipulative and all that stuff, right? Mean and violent. So I get connected to other people. I earn trust. I earn respect, not just from other people, but from myself. I build self-esteem through doing these esteemable acts of doing the best that I can. And then I feel good, content, happy, a sense of relief. I'm not like having to clean up lies and all that shit. And then I don't need to change the way I feel because I feel okay. When I live in conflict with my values, if I have a value of honesty and I lie, I feel fear that I'm going to get caught, remorse, regret, guilt, shame. I lose trust. I lose respect. I lose self-esteem. If I sit in that long enough, I'm going to fucking use. To me, it like became a mathematical equation. What are my values? Put my behaviors in line with my values, and I can, and I will stay clean and recover and be the best person I can be. Now, part of the responsibility and accountability of that, of those, like putting those values into principle or into practice, is that I need to take care of myself by doing some therapy, et cetera, like be responsible for my own well-being. And I figured out that the way that I'm staying clean in a 12-step framework, because if you looked at like someone who believes in God and you said, honesty, integrity, compassion, kindness, responsibility, accountability, humility, like are those
even the serenity prayer? It's all I want the fucking serenity and the wisdom.
Yeah. You know? But does that fit for you? Yeah. Like if you're a religious person, do those values fit for you? And people go, yeah. And I go, okay, those are my spiritual principles.
Yeah.
And step 12 says we practice these principles in all our affairs, which means my affairs are my relationships. So if I practice all of those principles in my relationships, guess what? I get connected to people, which scientifically repairs the telomeres that are holding my chromosomes, like stop. It's, it literally physically stops the aging process of stress. I get connected to people, oxytocin, dopamine, all this stuff. I have support. I get trust. I get respect. I feel good about myself. Like, you know, there's just like,
that's so many, the whole thing. So many. Yeah.
That's recovery to me. I'm returned to a state of health. You know, then do I do that perfectly? Absolutely not. I just don't do it perfectly. So step 10 is going, did you live by those values? And I go, nah, I kind of like didn't show up for Chris on time. So then what I did, so I got away from those values and I got into like living in conflict with them. Then my job in step 10 is get back in line with those values, which is be accountable and responsible and go, hey man, you know what? Like, that's not okay. I should be there. I apologize. How can I make it right? Blah, blah, blah. I'm making amends in the moment so that you don't go on to a step 8 and, you know, rah, rah, rah. Like how I live by a 12-step program is figure out what my values are, what behaviors are aligned with those values, and doing the best I can at that. And that fits in a 12-step program without me believing in God. And I think that's, so when I say to you, you can get well any way you want, like you're living by a 12-step framework, or at least in line with the principles of a 12 without the, you're like, I don't live, I never wrote the steps. Like, well, it doesn't say write them. It says live by them.
Yeah. Right.
Like
right.
The very first place
is what I say. Right?
Yeah. Well, the very first way. Well, I disagree with that. I think that you have. Yeah. You haven't written them. Yeah. But the very first time the 12 step shows up was in the AA Big Book in 1939. And actually, there's step one, step two, step three. And in step four, it says, now is the time we put pen to paper. It doesn't say you write out an exhaustive step one. You write out an exhaustive. Like, it doesn't say that. And then it says in step eight, now we made a list. So there's literally two steps. Like, you know. Maybe you're like looking at your defects in step six, but you know, like the reason that we write them out is to try to make it simpler to understand and all that. But I think we kind of over egg the pudding sometimes, which means like we make it a bit too complicated. I think it's this: if you live by those values, you're working the steps.
Yeah.
You're literally working the steps.
Yeah. So maybe, okay, I'll change the language. I never work them with intent. Maybe I'll put it that
way. That's bullshit too. Yeah. You do have intent. You didn't work them.
I
have intent
to live that way. I didn't work the step specifically with intent. That's all. You know what I mean? Like I didn't go
you didn't sit
the
down
process.
With step one, step two. Yeah. But the thing is like you definitely admitted that you're powerless and your life had become unmanageable.
Yeah, I did.
Well, that's step one, right?
You came
to believe that a power greater than you could restore you to sanity. When you're in your addiction, your decision-making is kind of insane. Right?
Yeah, it is.
It's not logical. Yeah, yeah. You act against your own best interest and all that. And then you came to believe that someone could help you to get out of that, whether that was 12-step people, reaching out to family, coming to treatment, like whatever. You believed that something could help you. That's step two. Step three, you made a decision to turn your will in life or your will in your life over to the care. So I don't know how you do that. That's your own personal sort of journey. But, you know, I can sit here and go like, you know, you're living a step 10 every day. Like you're living it. You're working it. Right.
Yeah.
And it is intentional. Yeah. It's just not laid out in that framework, but it's, you're doing the exact same thing someone does who does it in that framework.
Yeah. Fair enough. Right. Fair enough. Yeah. And thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, you're welcome. You're a 12 stepper.
I wouldn't, you know, take any shame in that.
Well, you shouldn't. It's an important thing.
While we're here, I mean, we talk about Yatra quite a bit, as you've been title sponsor for many episodes as of late, but, if people want to know more about you, what are they going to do? How are they going to reach you?
YatraCenter.com. And of course I do sometimes regret that I spelt it with the English spelling of center.
I regret that you did too.
I just have to explain it to everyone, especially everyone from North America. CENTRE.com. But if you look up Yatra Center, even the other way in Thailand, whatever,
it's
you'll
find
us.
Around. Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. Yeah, and, I know it's such a cumbersome thing to have to say at the end of every single title sponsor, right? Yeah,
I know.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, and you only say it for title sponsorship. I say it every day. I look back and I go, "What the fuck was I thinking?" Terminally unique, right? I think part of it is like I've spent the last 10 plus years working with a lot of people from around the world, including a really big contingent of people from the UK and Australia. And I think it's just the English spelling of it. Right. So you go to yatracenter.com. You can email us, hello@yatracenter.com. We've got on the website, there's like different resources. There's probably some videos and stuff on there. Sorry, I don't really go to my own website very often. But you can definitely contact us through that. And of course,
absolutely.
Make sure you listen to Ashes to Awesome.
Yeah. Right. So, and if to make that really easy, guys, on the website, 888podcast.com/trauma, it brings you to Mike, all his episodes, his links, it's all there, right, to get in touch. So that's a pretty easy way to do it as well, right? And
if after this episode you would want to do that.
Well, I can tell you, right? Listen, you know, we've gone into the hour and a quarter mark already, so why don't we get into the final segment of the show, which is, of course, my favorite part of the show, and that is the daily gratitudes. What you got for us today, Mike?
Oh, man. I'm such a broken record with this stuff because my world is quite small and I'm like in a transitional sort of time. But as always, I am, well, I'll say this, you know what, today I'm grateful for, 12 step recovery. I'm grateful for, everything I got from every person along the way that supported me in the meetings, who didn't judge me, even when I relapsed lots of times, who, applied tradition 3 and just let me keep coming back and encouraged me to keep coming back, you know, and then it was funny. Someone actually said to me, like, you're coming back anyway, so you may as well come back clean. And I was like, oh, fuck, that makes sense. But, you know, I'm grateful for all those people. I'm grateful for the first, like, really heavy 12-step involvement that I had in the first 5 years of my recovery, and then the involvement that's gone on in the intervening 15 years since then, which has tapered off a bit, but I still will always identify as that. For the friends and relationships that I made in those rooms and then moved outside of those rooms and into my life, which, like I say, is probably 85% of my friend network are people that are top-notch, amazing people that I met in those rooms that I wouldn't be where I was at without them. And then I'm always grateful for my wife and grateful for we had a wedding anniversary a couple of days ago. So, you know,
congratulations. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. So she's always top of the charts with the gratitudes, but because she's a trooper and a champ. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah. Awesome.
Thanks for asking.
I've got a couple of different ones. So the show is past a year mark now. So it's about, right.
Yeah, congratulations.
That was a few weeks ago. I kind of let it come and go without any sort of fanfare, but I got a couple messages. One, and I don't know if I think I might've told you about this. The drummer from Hootie and the Blowfish, reached out
to me. Really?
No. Yeah. He's like, hey man, friend of yours told me about I want to know who the friend was. Right. Yeah. Hey, you want to come on? Or he's, I'd love to be on your podcast. I think what you're doing is great. And it was like, whoa, man. Right. And that, now that's kind of the first person that's approached me of that. And I'm a 90s kid. So like, that's a like, whoa. Right. So all of a sudden, you know, I'm going like,
to brush with greatness.
You know, I'm right on the YouTube fucking reliving my, you know, my teens there. Right. But,
awesome.
Yeah. So he's coming on. We're recording here in a couple of days, actually on Friday.
Oh, amazing.
Friday night. Yeah,
good for you. That's
super
really
excited,
cool.
Right? It was kind of like this. I like to use the term validation of purpose, but it's not that. It's just like that's validation of effort, maybe, right? That the show has kind of gotten to that place, right? So,
I mean, I think it's both, because without the effort, you wouldn't get there, but without the purpose, he wouldn't be attracted to being on the show.
Fair enough. You know, fair enough, right?
And without you being who you are, he also wouldn't do that, right? So,
yeah, right.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, it's really big. Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And the other one was a message from, believe it or not, my arresting officer. My last arresting officer, right? He reached out to me, I don't know, 3 days ago. I was like, who the fuck is this? This is on Facebook. Like, I don't know your name. He's like, it's so-and-so. I'm the guy that, you know, whoa, right? You know, and I'm not going to get into that whole story. It was a big to-do, right? It was a big to-do.
Oh, okay.
My last arrest was, right?
I thought you weren't going to get into the story of the conversation.
No.
Like, but that's what we're here for.
he reached out. He's no longer part of the drug squad. He's moved into to murder cop in these days. But he reached out to me to say, like, hey, I see what you're doing. And holy shit, man. Congrats. Like, it was like, whoa.
Wow.
Right?
Amazing.
Like,
yeah.
A year and a half ago, right? Fuck off, cop.
That would have been
right?
Yeah. He would have been contacting you for something different.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So that was a big deal. That really was for me, right? That was
crazy.
It was a couple big things this week. Yeah.
You know. I would like to say that I'm not a huge fan of all police officers based on my lived experience. But to hear that there's one that like has a choice point in his life to be like, could I reach out to this person and say, kudos to you for what you're doing. Like, I see you from there to here, and that's big.
Right.
Because he has a choice. He can do that or he can just not, right? And the fact that he did that when he didn't need to is like, that's pretty big, right? And I think that's you know, actually something that probably not many people have experiences like that. And that's,
no kidding,
that's
right?
A huge thing.
And it's not like we had a friendly relationship, right?
But
there was 5 minutes in the room, you know, when it was all after the thing, and I'd been sitting for 12 hours, and when they brought me into the room and said, so, and it was like, fuck you, man. Right. Like, and that was like the end of our relationship. So for him to come, it was a big deal, man. It was a big deal. So I feel pretty great about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a couple of things to be grateful for. Right. And of course, I am also very grateful to every single person who continues to watch, listen, share, support in any which way that you do, right? buy a hoodie, guys. I don't have the thing up behind me. Maybe I'll. But, you know, we got the new hoodies coming out. Mom's working with me. We got new hoodies coming. We got new stickers coming. We're going to, this whole You Are Loved message is getting out there to the masses. So I'm pretty grateful for that. Hey, guys, anytime you do any one of these things, you're getting me a little bit closer to living my best life. My best life is to continue making a humble living, spreading the message. The message is this. If you're in active addiction right now, today could be that day. Today could be the day that you start a lifelong yatra. Reach out to a friend. Reach out to a family member. Go to church. Go to a meeting. Call into detox. I don't care. Do whatever it is you've got to do to get that journey started. It is so much better than the alternative. If you have a loved one who's suffering an addiction right now, you've taken the time to listen to our conversation. If you could just take one more minute out of your day and text that person, let them know they are loved. Use the words.
You are loved.
That little glimmer of hope just might be the thing that brings them back.